Welcome to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. The history of anti-slavery abolitionist activism is a rich and important period in American history, but there are so many stories that still have yet to be written. Samuel Ringold Ward is one of those activists, an important figure in the African-American activist community, working against slavery, working against racism, but whose story is largely lost. Thankfully, our guest, R.J. M. Blackett, has addressed this need to tell Ward's story in a new book, Samuel Ringold Ward, A Life of a Struggle. R.J. M. Blackett is Andrew Jackson Professor of History Emeritus at Vanderbilt University. His previous books include A Captive's Quest for Freedom, Fugitive Slaves, The 1850 Fugitive Slave Law, and The Politics of Slavery, Making Freedom, The Underground Railroad, and The Politics of Slavery. And today's book, once again, Samuel Ringold Ward, A Life of a Struggle. Professor Blackett, thank you very much for joining us.
Good to be here.
I will readily admit that before I read your book, I had not heard of Samuel Ringold Ward. So I guess the first question, am I uncommon or is this a story that generally has been lost to history until your book?
It's not unusual. Ward is a person that has captured the attention of those of us who have worked in the anti-slavery movement. He was a prominent figure in the movement, but he has the unique distinction of disappearing from the United States permanently. And that is a distinction that I think has affected our ability to keep in to track him down and to keep him at the center of the story that we tell. He disappears, and for Black Americans who I have been studying for decades, those who leave America leave its history. And I think Ward is one of those figures who went into exile beginning in 1850, and never returned. And that, to some extent, accounts for why we know so little about him. We also are burdened by the fact that we don't know a great deal about what he did when he moved to Jamaica. And that has been, that took up a great deal of my time trying to piece together those stories. I knew much more about Ward as part of the Anglo-American anti-slavery movement because my first book covered those Black Americans who visited England in the period before the Civil War to try and win support for abolition. And Ward was a figure in that movement, but then he disappears as he leaves England and he goes to Jamaica. So my effort was to try and fill in those many gaps in his life. And that is a larger problem in African-American history. There are so many gaps in the biographical details of individuals about whom we know, even among those that we know a great deal about. And Ward falls into that category.
Now, how much is this sort of a historiographical question in that, you know, you talk about the challenge of just finding information about certain parts of his life and trying to be able to fill in some of those gaps. And how much is this, I mean, since he leaves the country, he kind of leaves the narrative. And so a little bit of a, you know, from a perspective of a historian, of kind of an out of sight, out of mind, since this is an American history, if you're no longer in the United States, you're kind of self-selecting to remove yourself from the narrative. And so even if there was more information, there's a tendency to marginalize, you know, even ignore the people who leave the country.
Yes, yes. And there were contemporaries of his who left for long periods of time. I can think of Alexander Crummell, who also attended the same school that Ward did in New York City. Crummell also faced enormous pressure trying to just survive in 19th century America. He lived long stretches of poverty. He could not gain entry to the Episcopalian seminary because of his race. And in the end, he sort of gave up and went to England, got his degree from Cambridge University. It tells you something about the man's mettle. And then decided to move to Liberia, where he lived for almost 30 years. But he returned towards the end of his life and sort of re-entered the history of America. War didn't. For some of us who are interested in Ward, that is one of the tragedies of his life. He doesn't return. The story doesn't get picked up, and we simply lose sight of.
And so, first off, as a biography, you're telling a lot of the narrative of who this person, Samuel Ward, is. Could you walk us through what is his background? You know, how does he become a significant figure in the abolition movement?
Speaking of gaps, we first know that Ward was born a slave in the opening sentence of his autobiography. That was published in London in 1855. Ward didn't know he was born a slave until his parents kept it a secret. His mother informed his wife, Ward's wife, when Ward was 24 years of age, that he was actually born a slave. So his life, for the biographer, starts with a mystery. And his life in Jamaica ends in a mystery. And I have always thought, and I thought very hard about this as I was putting the biography together, what impact this new information had on him. But he never divulges anything about it. He continues as though it was quite normal. But it seems to me, have always thought I were a free black man, to be informed at age 24 that I was born a slave, what does that do to me? And how do I deal with it? Because it means that in terms of American law, Ward cannot prove he is a free black man. Free blacks, traditionally in the slave system, would have a free paper, a piece of paper saying Fred is free. But somebody in Ward's condition has no such documentation. And one wonders what sort of psychological impact it had on him. But I have no gift in that department. And therefore I sort of do what historians do, is you just skirt the subject. I just couldn't do it. But it must have been an enormous event, one of those pivotal moments in one's life. But how the historian, from my vantage point, deals with that, I couldn't come up with an explanation. Ward doesn't provide us with anything. I think I have found only two times where he mentions he was born a slave. In all the hundreds of lectures that he gave in the United States, in Canada, and in England, only on two occasions. So we don't know where in Maryland, Eastern Shore of Maryland, he was born, and we don't know who his owners were. In fact, about a week or two ago, I got a letter from somebody in Georgia, a minister. There's a town in Georgia called Ringgold. And this minister wrote me saying, does it have any connection with Ward's owner? And I couldn't answer them. I said, I don't think it does, although it is a very unique name. He has a cousin, a contemporary, who is also big in the anti-slavery movement, who also has a curious middle name. But that was an adopted middle name, Henry Highland Garnett. That was not Garnett's birth name. And why that those interesting middle names? It wasn't Fred or Richard or James. Ringgold. And I've never come across anybody with that name. So, there's a lot of mystery surrounding Ward, which may help to explain why we know so little about it.
And what you're highlighting here, then, when I think of the nature of his activism, of course, what seemed to be the primary issue, obviously, you know, abolition broadly, but in particular, the emphasis on the Fugitive Slave Act, which, I mean, I guess at one level, it's a sign of his times. That was the most important issue that had arisen during this period of intense activism, what, the 1840s, you know, early 1850s. But it also is at least an invitation to consider that a man who's born a slave and so doesn't have the documentation that would guarantee that he wouldn't be ensnared by the Fugitive Slave Act. I don't think you'd have to be a psychologist to reason that that's clearly a huge motivation as to why he sees this as such a significant threat, a threat to his own personal freedom, as well as broadly to the freedom of African-Americans in the country.
There were contemporaries of him in similar situations. His old friend, Jermaine Logan from Syracuse, he escaped from slavery as a teenager in Tennessee. So his problem, and he was very active in the Underground Railroad and the anti-slavery movement. So one of the messages is that these vulnerable people, to some extent, defied their vulnerability in attacking the system. And the question for me, another question that I've never been able to resolve is what personal price they paid for that effort, for that attacking of the system. It must have been an enormous burden on them, and it must have affected their sense of belonging, the sense of who they were, the sense of why the country that they had, about which they had fought so hard to improve, continued to defy their best efforts. So those are kind of large issues, to some extent, provide a sort of motive force for trying to understand the details of the life. At the same time, you have to recognize that these people were ordinary folk. You know, they had spouses, they had children, they had to make a living, and they had to prepare themselves to defy the system that is denying them their rights. It's a heavy burden.
Absolutely. And you're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're discussing a new biography of Samuel Ringgold Ward, A Life of a Struggle, with the author R.J. Black Hat of Vanderbilt University. Part of what you're describing is the challenges that Ward faced at just, you know, making a living, being able to provide for his family. Let's get into the person of, you know, who was Samuel Ward. And one of the things that struck me from the book is just how accomplished he was as an orator, that there were accounts of him as just delivering eloquent, thoughtful lectures. Is that what he's most known for, is these, you know, these beautiful lectures, these beautiful speeches?
His speeches were many times impromptu as well. That is what I think I end the book by saying. Is one of his contemporaries, James McEwen Smith, another one of those students from that school in New York, another one of those Black Americans who had to leave the country to get an education, in this case, in Smith's case in Scotland, said that he was the most accomplished speaker on his feet. He could do things extemporaneously. He had a biting sense of humor. And And that is what I think made him so well known among his contemporaries. But that biting sense of humor also got him in trouble with friends and colleagues, because he rarely minced his words. He didn't take fools kindly. And he believed that people should approach life in the same way he did. And he rarely gave people the kind of quarter that you would under normal circumstances. So the gift that he possessed was both his strength, but also to some extent a weakness. It worked against him at times.
Maybe the most well-known activist, abolitionist activist, African-American abolitionist is Frederick Douglass. And you do go into some details about Ward's relationship with Douglass, some of the similarities and differences. But actually, I guess the first question I'd like to ask is about his actual relationship. Were they allies? Were they friends? Were they rivals? How much aware were they of one another's work?
Oh, they were very much aware. I mean, they lived sort of 30 miles as the crow flies in New York. They acted in tandem on many occasions. Ward always kept Douglass as a sort of measure of the potential of Black Americans. And Douglass thought that Ward was the best orator of his time. There's that, I opened the book with that long evaluation of Ward towards, as Douglass is looking back over 40, 50 years of agitation and political involvement, and recognizing that of his peers, Ward was the best at what he did. And together, they worked in tandem to put down some of the more rabid racist assaults on the abolitionist movement. And Ward would tease Douglass because Douglass had a white father. And as you see from the description that I quote some of them at length, Ward was unadulterately Black and proud of it. And Ward would tease Douglass at times about being tarred by the white brush, as he said, I think he said it one time. But nonetheless, he recognized that together they accomplished great things, although they differed over the best means to achieve emancipation. Douglass started off as a Garrisonian and drifted away from it. Ward, to a large extent, believed that the future of emancipation rests in the ability to use the political system to bring about changes. But even from those two different vantage points, they worked very closely together. Although they were competing editors and they had competing newspapers, they tended to work very closely together.
Now, you make references in particularly the early chapters of the book to the Liberty Party. And I know that this is a period where there's this fraying of the Whig Party over the issue of slavery, and eventually it's going to give rise to a Republican Party made up of largely anti-abolitionist Whigs. But there are these other parties that are emerging during this period. And so I didn't know terribly much about the Liberty Party. Could you describe, you know, what was the Liberty Party? What exactly was it trying to accomplish, and how did it differ from some of the other existing parties?
Put simply, the Liberty Party and its adherents believed you couldn't tackle slavery politically by voting for parties who failed to criticize slavery, right? There were slaveholders in the Whig Party, There were slaveholders in the Democratic Party. Those who believed in the political means to reach abolition believe you couldn't do that by living a contradiction, by continuing to vote for the Whig Party when the Whig Party refuses both to endorse the right of Black New Yorkers to get their votes back, as well as refusing to criticize slavery openly. So that was the Liberty Party's agenda. It started off as a one platform party, abolition of slavery. It later on broadened its agenda in an attempt to attract more people into the fold, but by and large, it remained. It competed in two presidential elections and won very, very few votes. So that by the end of the 1840s, the Liberty Party is, to all intents and purposes, a rump party. It loses much of its supporters to the Free Soil Party, which emerges in 1848, which tries to broaden the appeal beyond simply slavery, while maintaining their anti-slavery credentials by saying that slavery could not expand into the territories that had been gained from Mexico at the end of the Mexican-American War. But so the Liberty Party is a very focused agenda. It's largely a one-platform party, and in spite of its later efforts to change, to broaden, it never does it. And Ward is its principal spokesman in New York. It's quite clear.
Ultimately, then, does the Liberty Party find itself aligned with this new Republican Party that's founded, 1854, that ended up taking up a lot of trying to take the mantle of the Whig Party and make it decidedly abolitionist? Is that what happens to the Liberty Party? Do most of them become Republicans after Republicans were founded?
Many joined the Free Soil Party first. And then when the Free Soil Party failed to get traction, some went over to the Republican Party. But there was a small die-in-the-wool Liberty Party group of people who never changed their allegiance, who maintained their position, although the party, to all intents and purposes, did not exist by the time you get the formation of the Republican Party in the middle of the 1850s. So the Republican Party becomes a strange amalgam of anti-slavery positions, some of which are openly calling for emancipation, some of which speak of free soil principles, others still maintain that free blacks, once they are emancipated, should be encouraged to leave the country. So the Republican Party is a very strange amalgam of different anti-slavery positions.
And what does Ward fit into all of this? Was he one of those who never joined?
No. He remained a stalwart of the Liberty Party. And he maintained his allegiance until he left the country in 1851. And by moving to Canada, he in effect separated himself from the day-to-day struggles of American politics.
And that's an important part of this narrative, is when he chooses to leave the country. What's the reason why he chooses to originally to move to Canada?
Well, he says in his autobiography that he and his wife, he was in bankruptcy court in Boston in the early 1850s, in 1851. And as part of meeting the demands of the the resolution of that bankruptcy, he and his wife went on an extended tour of the West, in which he lectured and tried to raise money. But on his way home, his story is that they were reading a newspaper in which there was a description of the Christiana shootout in Pennsylvania, in which a slaveholder was killed and a nephew of his seriously injured while they were attempted to recapture a fugitive slave. And he and Ward said that he and his wife decided that there was no future for them in America and they would move to Canada. And on his way home, he stopped in Syracuse in the middle of a famous fugitive slave case, the Jerry Rescue case, in which he became involved. And as a fugitive slave himself, became immediately open to being captured and by the government, who by this period is determined to crush opposition to the fugitive slave law. So it is at that point that Ward left the country, never to return.
And with that, we'll take a break. And when we return, we're going to talk about Ward's experiences in Canada, his attitude about the United States once he leaves the country, moves to Canada, and then delve into some of the ideological, some of the arguments that he makes about Black empowerment, about Black freedom, in particular, in light of the fact that Canada may have been opposed to slavery, but they were not necessarily immune from a phrase that Professor Blacker uses pretty regularly about Negro hatred once he goes abroad. So please stay tuned. Welcome back to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. On today's show, we're discussing a new biography of a Black activist, abolitionist, political figure, speaker, important figure in history, Samuel Ringle Ward, The Life of a Struggle. It's a new biography written by R.J.M. Blackett, who is the Andrew Jackson Professor of History Emeritus at Vanderbilt University. He's discussing his new book with us. So when we left off, Professor Blackett, we talked about Ward going to Canada, you know, leaving the country and moving to Canada. And one of the things you emphasized at this point is it didn't take him terribly long to decide he was no longer American, that he really embraced his new, you know, his new identity, that he was Canadian. What was behind that decision? I mean, when he left the U.S., he left America behind and he had moved on.
Very early in his time in Canada, he wrote to Douglas a very telling letter in which he said to him, "Fred, America is yours. Take it. I want no part of it. I want none of its Negro hate. I want none of its slavery. I am going to make a life for myself and my family in Canada." And as a result, Ward tended to paint an overly rosy picture of the prospects for Blacks in Canada. That wasn't unusual among his contemporaries. There were a significant number of Blacks who moved to Canada in the period before 1850 and continued in the decades leading up to the Civil War. There were settlements of blacks in Canada. Blacks could acquire land. They could go to school. The laws didn't say, didn't discriminate against them, although the application of the laws were not always free and fair. But Ward therefore saw a future in a place where he thought he could leave his mark. But as in the case of the United States, poverty always stalked him. He had no, I suppose, in spite of his best efforts, he had no appreciable skills. He could teach, but teaching didn't bring in much money. He became an agent of the Canadian, the Anti-Slavery Society of Canada. That provided him with some money, but it was never enough to keep the wolves from the door. So Canada, in spite of its better prospects, as far as Ward was concerned, did little to help his bank account. And that is one of the tragedies of his life. Wherever he went, he ran into similar problems. Canada was no different from America in that sense.
Yeah, and although he was freed, at least ostensibly, from the Fugitive Slave Act, although there's a lot of interesting research that suggested being in Canada didn't mean you were completely immune, that there were definitely examples of slave hunters slipping over the border and seizing fugitive slaves, you know, from Canada. He was generally freed, at least of some of the more intense security risks of being a fugitive slave. But he didn't find Canada to be all that, I guess I can call it race neutral, but a better way to describe it is Canada had plenty of racial hatred as well, correct?
It was developing that way. But what Ward was keen to show that Canada had the potential to afford Blacks the opportunity to integrate themselves into Canadian society. In ways that they could not do in the United States. And in that sense, he is correct. There were a few racist politicians who were pushing the same old nonsense that he had been fighting in the United States. But those were those had fewer powers to impose their will. So Canada, as a British colony, had emancipated its slaves. And that for Ward, as for many of those who moved to Canada, was a step in the right direction. It wasn't perfectly free of Negro hate, as Ward would say, but it was better than what he had left behind. And that mattered to him.
And there's a line, you know, that you'll cite about Ward's own identity, that he identified himself as a Canadian and I believe as a British subject pretty much as soon as he goes. And one of the lines that really stuck out to me with some real salience to contemporary politics was, a country that did not love me is not a country that I could love. And so was his embrace of Canada. You're describing, at least in part, this the potential for Blacks in Canada. But was it also, it was a rejection of the U.S. because in his estimation, I can't love a country that refuses to love me.
Yes, yes, absolutely. So he becomes, in his own mind, a British subject. I don't think he had a British passport. It wouldn't have been necessary for him to travel to England or to travel to Jamaica. But he sees himself increasingly after he moves to Canada as a British subject. And that is why that experience on the ship, traveling from New York to Liverpool on an English ship, so hurt him and created such another one of those crises. but he explains it. And that's one of Samuel Ward's gifts. He has the intellectual capacity to explain things in ways that make sense to the historian looking at his life. That ship, he argued, had to, in order to be economically successful, had to cater to white Americans. And unless and until such time, Black Americans achieved a kind of economic clout so as to influence these kind of capitalists, then they would continue to have to endure these kind of racial discriminations. But he made the best of what was and what was a must have been a humiliating experience for Ward. Douglas went through it. William Wells Brown's daughters went through it. So the people who were traveling on this British liner, the Cunard liner, they have to endure these kind of racial racial slights because the shipping company has money to be made, is money to be made, and that is to be made by doing what it can to accommodate the needs of its white American clientele.
Go. Now, Ward doesn't stay in Canada. He ends up going to Jamaica after that. What was driving his movement, you know, out of Canada throughout, you know, other parts of the English speaking world? I guess, what was he seeking? Was this purely monetary, or were there other motivations?
Well, he was hired as the agent of the Canadian Anti-Slavery Society to go to England in 1853 to raise funds to support their work among fugitive slaves in Canada. I can't think of a better person better equipped to do that than Ward, nor could his Canadian colleagues. So they thought he would go over there. He would spend, say, 18 months to a couple of years, raise money for the society, and then return to Canada. The decision to ask him to take on this agency comes as Uncle Tom's Cabin, the novel, is really turning up the transatlantic world. And they thought Ward would be able to exploit that to good effect. And he did. But the money he made was minimal. It was not enough to keep him going. He had, as he had done in the United States, and as he had done in Canada, he had to take on additional lectures in order to make ends meet. I am not sure if he ever sent money back to his family in Toronto. It is not clear that he did. While he was living in England, they were living hand to mouth in Toronto, supported to some extent by the Canadian Anti-Slavery Society. His children were too young to work, and his wife, Emily, doesn't seem to have worked either. So the hardship that he endured in America and in Canada follows him to England. If there's a thread that runs through his life, that's it. Hardship. Penury, overexertion in an attempt to make ends meet, resulting in bouts of illnesses that he suffered throughout his life.
And you're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're discussing a new biography of the abolitionist, anti-slavery activist, Samuel Ringold Ward, A Life of a Struggle, with its author, R.J.M. Blackett, of Vanderbilt University. And in this last section, I'd really like to sort of delve into some of his, you know, some of his thinking about ways in which to redress race hate and to broadly to empower the Black community, the African-American community. I know you make references, his own references, to the importance of the phrase you use, and I suspect this is what Ward uses, is self-elevation or some forms of self-empowerment really at its core. Could you talk a bit about, you know, the role that that plays in sort of the prescription that Ward would give to individual African-Americans, individual Blacks, about the best way to achieve, you know, a community empowerment through your own individual empowerment?
Yes, yes. Self-elevation is a tenet of mid-19th century Anglo-American society. It's not just a Black thing, but Blacks, many believed that others might be able to help. But by and large, improvement will come through self-exertion, through one's own commitment to improve oneself. The problem with that analysis, and it's stared Ward in the face throughout his life, that in spite of all his efforts, he could not do it on a personal level. And that is the great frustration. That is the great frustration of his life. And that was the great frustration of the Black experience in mid-19th century. In spite of what they did, there was a system in place that denied them basic human rights. And if you look at someone like Ward, a man who has educated himself in ways that continue to impress me, his command of the classics, his command of history, of broadly defined, of classical history, of African history, of the history of the Black experience, all of those things that he did, his efforts, his becoming ordained as a minister, his dabbling in medicine and law, nothing seemed to work. And in that sense, then, Ward's life is a statement about the limits of self-elevation. Self-elevation without societal means to endorse individual abilities runs up against all the things that Ward was fighting for. So in that sense, he, Douglas, and all the others that fought so diligently to promote their own, to build up their own self-awareness as well as their skills, run up against this societal limit that they couldn't overcome. Hmm. And fortunately for Ward, to some extent, by opting out, he doesn't become a victim of the cycles of hope and despair that people like Douglas faced. The hope of emancipation and reconstruction dashed by the time we get to the end of the 19th century. That That would have, I think, devastated Ward had he experienced something like that. He didn't, by becoming what he would call a British subject. But those huge cycles of American open retreat, he didn't have to experience. But it is there in the middle, it's there in the 19th century. So self-elevation runs up against that political reality. And it's a reality that we have still not broken through.
Yeah, I was thinking that what you're describing here and what you describe in the book has a remarkable salience in 2023, that the idea that whether or not a person of color, whether or not an African-American is successful, the sort of the traditional, or at least traditional is not the right word, the certainly white dominated American ideal of your success, your failure is driven by your own self-elevation, your own development of your skills, how hard you work, et cetera, versus the ongoing critique of what we might call structural racism problems, or, you know, just a system that's butting up against anybody's ability to succeed solely on the basis of self-elevation. And so part of reading your book and thinking about this question reminds me, first of all, this is not a new topic by any stretch of the imagination. This type of analysis is not new, despite what some of the critics of a structural approach might suggest, that this is not something that's new, and that the story of Ward is at least in part a story of so many brilliant Black activists, Black entrepreneurs, et cetera, butting heads with structural racism. Is that, how much is his story a reminder that the issues we face today are issues that we face, frankly, throughout the history of the Republic?
Yep, it has been there at the core of American history. And all people like Ward and Douglas are doing is saying to America, live up to your first principles. It is those principles that you articulated that are the foundation of the society. And that principle says, quite simply, all men are created equal. Let's find a way to achieve that objective on both an individual and on a race basis, for the entire race. Just do it. And America has, at periods in its history, inched its way to that, towards that objective, and then retreats in a gallop. And it is that inability in Ward's time to live up to those first principles that frustrated him and his contemporaries no end. Some of them managed to experience the highs of Reconstruction, only again to be dashed later on in the century. But that is the overarching thread that runs through the African American experience and it is one that today we find ourselves in situations in which we are revisiting these old issues and not seeing the historical significance of it.
Another key issue, you know, that gets raised, I think has some extremely important contemporary implications, is the way to strengthen the Black community and sort of assimilation versus segregation, and how much faith can you put in progressive thinking whites at different times. You describe Ward's relationship, believing that so many of them were patronizing and not necessarily as supportive. But the big broad question is, the best way to elevate the Black community through strengthening a Black community separate from whites versus assimilation. And I know there were issues, for instance, with the Refugee Home Society issues that get raised, the RHS Society, on those questions. Where would Ward fall on that question of building our community separate from whites versus trying to promote much more of an assimilation as a way to try to overcome some of these challenges?
I think Ward strongly believed in the potential for integrated action. It is what is at the heart of the abolitionist movement, an abiding faith that people working across racial lines can improve the situation for all, can eliminate, can bring an end to slavery, and in doing so, affect what he liked to call Negro hate. He believed it, and there's evidence in his life that that was possible. His two churches were both white churches. So that he knew America was looking at himself and his congregations to see if it was possible to do what they hoped to do. And that experiment, I think, was critical. Ward really, although he recognized the centrality of the Black church to the Black community, he nonetheless believed that there was too much splintering. There were too many churches that took their cue not from a sort of intellectual understanding of Christianity, but spent much too much time hollering and making noise rather than elevating the people in the congregation. So he believed strongly in the church, but he believed in a church that was not attached to slavery. And he believed that through his own experiences, both among, in his two congregations, that there was that hope for it. Of course, when he gets to Jamaica, he becomes involved in the Baptist church. And as I try to show in the section on Jamaica, Baptist politics was nothing if not crazy in Jamaica. And there was, like many churches, internal dissension and infighting. But Ward was a firm believer, I think, in the power of integrated action and cross-racial solidarity. Although, like in all movements of its kind, there were internal racial tensions over the extent to which they could be egalitarian. It's there in the abolitionist movement. It's there in the 20th century in the civil rights movement. It is unavoidable because America continues to have a problem with race that it has not resolved. So, but I think he was a believer, and he lived that belief that cross-racial, that interracial cooperation was the best prescription for success.
And last question, about 90 seconds left, but I do want to ask this. You describe Ward, you know, throughout the book, is incredibly eloquent, this very effective speaker, and make references to some of his speeches. Are most of his speeches archived? Are we able to go and read his speeches, or is the access to these speeches relatively limited?
They're limited. They are very limited. We get secondhand descriptions of them. We can get snippets of them from contemporary newspapers. And 19th century editors were very proud of their skill at shorthand and transcription. So many of them covered his speeches extensively. And in that way, we can get at them. But there's no compilation, there's no place, there's no source in which all his speeches have been brought together.
And that, by the way, might explain why Samuel Ward has been lost a bit to history, because somebody like Frederick Douglass, you know, had written so much, and we have his words. But unfortunately, if you've got somebody like Samuel Ward, whose words have kind of been lost to history because we don't have this collection, we don't have this archive, it's easy to forget him, his messages, and the impact that he played. But fortunately, we have historians like you, Professor Blackett, who can give us these narratives, who can give us these histories, and remind us as we examine Black history, we examine the impact of these incredible activists, that without any disrespect to people like Frederick Douglass, there are so many more that we should be examining, and a just rich well of knowledge, a rich well of history that we should all be engaging in so we can learn these incredible stories. Today, we've been discussing the life, the history, the biography of Samuel Ringold Ward. New book, Samuel Ringold Ward, A Life of a Struggle, tells this story. The author is R.J.M. Blackett, Andrew Jackson Professor of History Emeritus at Vanderbilt University. And his previous books are The Captive's Quest for Freedom, Fugitive Slaves, The 1850 Fugitive Slave Law and the Politics of Slavery, and Making Freedom, The Underground Railroad and the Politics of Slavery. Thank you very much for joining us. This is a wonderful book.
Thanks for the opportunity.
I'd like to give a special thanks to the Scholar Circle team, Maria Armudian, host and anchor, Ankine Agassian, managing producer, Sud Dongri, webmaster and production assistant, and Mahika Chechi is our intern. All Scholar Circle shows are archived on scholarcircle.org. You can find our podcast on Apple and Google Podcast and iTunes. Please follow us on at Scholar Circle Twitter account, and please join our Facebook page. On behalf of the Scholar Circle team, I am Doug Becker. Thank you for listening.